coming at you from Brooklyn, New York. We are here with Matt Cooper.
Welcome to the Chris Ruggiero Podcast.
Thanks for listening, everyone. We are here with Matt Cooper, who is a mentalist slash mind reader slash not quite sure exactly what to call what he does. I liked his description, and he creates mysteries. So he creates mysteries for people's minds and makes you think about interesting things that you wouldn't have thought about before. And all while doing this in an entertaining way. So I've known him for a couple years now, met him in New York, and very interesting character. He's always kind of up to something interesting, and he's always creating new things. And every time I see him, he does some sort of crazy trick, illusion, mind reading type of thing that just blows me away. And I have no idea how he does it. So he really does create mysteries in my mind, and I hope in your mind. As well as doing that stuff, he has a blog, which I have been really enjoying. He writes about some different types of just thoughts, not really about entertainment usually or, you know, performing, but just thoughts on life and things like that. So you should check that out. You can check out his website. We'll talk about it later as well. It's whoiscooper.com. So we'll just get right into it. Here is my conversation with Who is Cooper? Matt Cooper. Here he is.
I spend my time creating mysteries, I suppose. That's my main interest. I'm a mentalist. People call that a mind reader. I really prefer not to give it a name, but it helps to give some people a kind of idea of what it is, and mentalist seems to fit that you know, that whole. And I earn my living primarily as a mystery guest for, like, fancy parties. So they hire me to walk around, drink their booze, eat their food, and read their minds. And lately I've been moving more towards sort of stage performing and trying to figure out what that world is like, because I think it's just more gratifying to, you know, be in the theater rather than doing someone else's house party or something.
Yeah. How does that translate for you to be from going from as like a mingling type guest to work into it's kind of more of a stage thing?
Sure.
I think maybe it seems like people think, oh, I do magic tricks. So you could show up at a party and do awesome stuff.
Yeah,
and then
you just
walk out on stage and do awesome stuff.
Right,
but
right.
But like as somebody like from the behind the scenes, that's like a whole different world.
Absolutely. Yeah, it feels completely different. I feel like I'm starting over from scratch completely. And that's, at first that was terrifying, but I think now that's more exciting than anything I could have possibly imagined, because now I don't feel tired and bored of what I'm doing anymore. It's like this getting to start over, like, you know, when I was 10 years old interested in magic tricks, but now I'm doing this, some, you know, something on stage, and it gives me an opportunity to rediscover, you know, magic or mind reading or all this kind of stuff with fresh eyes and kind of just constantly chop away at the ego. That's been a big thing for me, is getting rid of that feeling of, oh, I'm good enough, you know, to, oh shit, I have a lot to learn. And but that's a good thing. That's a really, really exciting thing. So that's kind of where I am now. I mean, I don't really know much about it, but that's a good place to be.
Yeah, we were talking on with Chris Shepherd of the Successful Performer Cast. I was talking with him about before, like, a big stage show, the imposter syndrome of what am I doing here? Yeah. How did I get to be this person?
Yeah. Sure.
Is fairly common with, I think, all levels of entertainers. Even people that you look at and think that they're like top of the, you know, top notch people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of curious. I don't really do like the walk around style things, but I'm always trying to figure out for myself, like, how do I get pumped up and like enter that mode of being on stage?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm like backstage, like doing wacky stuff. I'll be like doing push-ups and like running back and forth.
Sure.
Because I like to be, you know, mine's a little bit different because my show is a physical, like physically
energy,
demanding
show. Yeah.
So I like to be sweaty before I go out. Like when I walk out on stage, I want to be like, you know, I'm halfway into a 5K race.
Right, right.
Or then like that time when you just feel like you're going.
Yeah. Do you listen to music or anything? Does that kind of get you pumped up?
Not really. There's usually music playing in the room. Oh, so okay. I just have that kind of going. And my pre-show music is designed to kind of help people get excited. But I'm curious about that, like, before you do, like, a walk-around show. Are you, like, going over things in your head and thinking about things? Or are you at the point now where it's just, like, you can just show up and then as it naturally happens?
Yeah, I think at this point I'm just showing up and getting into it. There are... I wouldn't call them pre-show rituals. I mean, I always kind of polish my shoes before every gig. That's a thing I did back when I played baseball. Our coaches demanded that we respect the game. And in the same way, I feel like I should respect the, you know, performance. So I always, you know, in some degree polish my shoes. It's not always a big thing. It might just be 5 minutes of just, you know, quick polishing. And I tend to listen to music, but I always, always feel apprehensive and nervous. And I used to try to find ways of getting rid of that, you know, stopping that feeling from happening. But lately, I've kind of embraced that feeling more and more. I think it's like the feeling you have before you go to the bathroom, right? It's just a feeling that happens before you have to do something. So this is a feeling before either something I'm really afraid of doing, I could see it that way, or the way I prefer to see it is a feeling before something really great happens. Yeah. So those butterfly feelings are feelings of, wow, something intense is about to take place, and I'm going to be a part of that. I'm going to be part of the cause of that. And that's a really invigorating feeling, and it kind of gets me excited. And I also do some kind of visualization stuff if I feel really scared, where instead of visualizing it being a terrible experience, I just kind of see it going really well. And that tends to work for me. But by and large, I walk in. I know that feeling's going to be there, so I'm not surprised, and I just get on with it. It goes away pretty quickly, too, once you start. Yeah. You know, if the first group is successful, if it's not successful, that first group, it's just, it's really tough for me
to
get out of
it. Worse than when you started, it brings you even deeper into that.
Yeah, well, the first group is just not really responsive, or they're disinterested or whatever. I think that's my fault, and it might be my fault sometimes, but it's just really tough to pull you out of that. Whereas if the opening experience is such, you know, alive with energy, then it's like, oh, great, well, this is going to be awesome. And you feel much better about it. So, yeah, it's a case-by-case basis.
What's something that an opening group that didn't work out? Do you have a specific story of that ever happening where it wasn't quite the ideal?
Yeah. I used to do this gig in Las Vegas called the Sterling Club. And it was a very fancy, well-to-do club full of these, you know, these rich... they weren't elderly, but they were maybe in their... you know, 60s and hard of hearing. So constantly going there was actually quite difficult because I'd walk up to a group, they couldn't hear me going, you know, what? You know, that kind of thing. And I would say to them, I want you to think of a number between, you know, 1 and 100. But I would just say, I want you to think of a number. And they would go, Dean Martin, you know, New York, New York, or whatever it was, thinking I meant number of a song, you know. So that was... that was both hilarious. I kept asking them to think of a number because I wanted them to say that, but also kind of disappointing. So, but nothing really comes to mind apart from just bad venues where people can't hear you, or just a group that looks like they would be interested, but they're not. Maybe I just gauged them wrong, but nothing in particular that was horrible because it's never really that bad.
Yeah. What about the other side? What's the ideal if you had... you know, the world at your fingertips and you could mold this venue and audience into your perfect ideal world for you to enter and create these mysteries. What would it look like?
Is that for the close-up stuff or for stage?
You have the powers in your hands.
Well, I think
you can create anything you want. So what, for you personally, you know, which way would you go?
Oh, theater. 100%. Yeah. It would be in the theater, a beautiful theater. You know, I grew up in Vegas where you don't really have these classically magnificent theaters. Apart from there's a new theater in Vegas now called the Smith Center, which is gorgeous. I don't know if you've been to it. It's really impressive. It doesn't belong in Vegas, it feels like. It's weirdly transplanted there. Yeah. But there's nothing like, you know, like old English theaters or anything like that. So I think that's what I want more than ever, is to have this beautiful theater, an empty stage. Kind of like what you see in these old prints of old magic books of these masterminds on stage, hypnotizing someone, having a spirit fly across the room.
Yeah.
Those images that look so gorgeous, even though they're drawn or whatever, seem so satisfying and appealing to me that that's where it would be in that sort of venue.
Yeah.
But for close up, I always prefer having that, having like a table or a secret room or a space. I was working recently at the McKittrick Hotel, and they have a place called The Heath inside the McKittrick. And there's this train booth in the hallway, and just like a facsimile of a train with a draw curtain. And I just grabbed some people, I pulled them in there, and I started performing for them one-on-one. They left, and someone else came back in. Before I knew it, there was a line of people coming to see the mind reader.
Yeah.
And that was really satisfying. And I think that's because the space changed in a way where they were coming to see me rather than me coming up to see them,
yeah,
or to show them something. So it's just a shift of dynamics, I think. And that really helped a lot.
Yeah, and that relates, that can kind of go towards so many things of changing that view of, you know, into like, even into crazy things like of marketing or, you know, selling your show onto the actual show, like, sure, as people are coming to hear about you, like, oh, I hope he is available to come to my show, instead of like being the, I'm trying to say here, like, I think as entertainers and people in show business, we start off like, okay, cool, I'll take whatever I can get, or I'll walk into the room and whoever looks bored, I'll go talk to them and entertain them.
Right.
And then as you switch that dynamic in whatever world it is where people are just like, where you're over here doing your thing.
Yeah.
And as people come and then it like builds up this thing and then you create it where the thing, and then once the line forms, then you don't have
it's done.
Do this.
Yeah.
They're doing it for you.
Yeah. Well, you learn it in, I think, in almost maybe middle school where you're trying to talk to girls or whatever, the more needy you are, the less interested they are.
Yeah.
So it's just about having the confidence to be able to hold court, maybe, and people are I think more attracted to that. Maybe. I mean, that's what it feels like, at least at this stage. But it's just a matter of neediness. If you feel the need to be really impressive all the time, then people are kind of, you know, skeptical.
Right.
But if you all just have that within you, that kind of magnetism, that natural charisma, people can sense that, I feel.
And having that sense of...
Not that I have that natural charisma, I'm not saying that.
I think you do have something there. Like, you know, and I've not really seen you do performances, but I've been hung out with you a few times.
Sure.
You're able to kind of have a presence.
Sure.
You know.
That's nice to say.
And in that world of having something that makes you, you know, appealing for people to either want to come talk to you or have you perform or whatever, how that goes, how is being in a place like New York where the world is typically not, the atmosphere of New York City is mostly like not a welcoming, real friendly place, but a lot of people are kind of in their
closed
own world.
Off. Yeah.
And, you know, it's more on the streets, maybe at a private party, people are a little bit different.
Sure.
But how does that kind of affect, you know, you've performed all over in different places as well. How does it affect being here in New York, kind of that world, as far as being a performer who you need to actually go approach people?
Right. I don't really know. I haven't had a lot of experience outside of like performing in a metropolis. It's been Los Angeles, Vegas, New York. I think these all have similar vibes.
Yeah.
As far as that busyness goes. But I think people are pretty responsive, particularly in New York, where there's an artistic or cultural feel to the whole thing, where people are more accepting of interesting art forms. I don't know. I've always really loved New York City for how unbelievably diverse it is and what you can expect to find. And I think that's been a big help, actually, compared to, say, growing up in rural Montana or something. I don't know. I mean, I imagine that would be much more difficult to be working in a Denny's in Montana than it is working in a nice kind of, you know, loft here in New York City. I find that atmosphere being really conducive to what I do. So I don't know. I haven't had much trouble with that, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I see what you mean. I see what you mean by that. I think the biggest thing is the phones, is that, you know, being sucked into this, that's probably, I mean, not that I've had people on their phones while I was performing, but that would be incredibly rude. I don't think anyone's really that rude in this world to actually physically, you'd be surprised, but it just hasn't really been a problem.
How about that with the phone thing of phones and internet videos and TV talent shows and stuff? As somebody who
kind of saw the world before that.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been thinking about that, you know, as like the age that, you know, this generation kind of started without it.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And now for the rest of history, things are going to be different. That has just been normal that you have the internet in your pocket. And I didn't have the internet at home when I was a little kid.
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't know what it was. It didn't exist really, like in the sense that it was. Now, how is that for somebody that's relying on, you know, entertaining people in real life, in person, face to face, whether in a walk around setting or a stage setting? How do you think that this new world of, you know, whatever you want to see, the biggest, craziest thing can be within 3 seconds, you can be watching it?
Yes. I think there will always and forever be a spot for live theater. I mean, you can watch the most incredible things in a cinema or on your phone, but they will never match the intensity of that feeling when it's done well inside of the space that you're in. It's just, there's nothing like it. When you're in the room with a good magician or a mind reader or just having, you know, witnessing a good play or anything like that, or a concert, these things are so much more magnetic than watching them on your phone. So I don't think there'll be a big thing that will stop that from ever happening. Unless, of course, we get to the scary world of, I don't know what you would call it, maybe, what was that movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Total Recall, I think, where they have like these false memories or these false experiences. I think that was the movie. But imagine a world where we could just plug in our brains and have alternate realities where we experience things that feel like what we're feeling right now.
Yeah.
That would be, I think, the demise of actual live theater. But how would you know? How would you know? How do we even know this is, not to get too stonery, but how do we even know this is a real thing, you know? So I don't really know. But the scary thing is, because like you're right, I grew up having to go outside and play with my friends and, you know, ride bikes, skateboard, blow things up, that kind of thing. I didn't have an iPad to play with. So I feel like, but I did have the TV, and before TV was around, they had radio. So I wonder, what's the next thing?
Yeah.
What are people going to say? You know, back when I was a kid, all we had were iPhones.
Yeah, all we could do was watch whatever we wanted.
What's an iPhone?
But we had to look at it. So you had to look at this screen.
Yeah.
So virtual reality and being entered into that world.
Right, yeah.
Is the thing. Like, I forget. It might have been you guys that were talking about it, of this, like, thing that they're experimenting with of when you're watching a show, whatever your favorite show is, but like there's like a basically a thing, a device is all over your living room that kind of send up like a fog, and it's acting as like a screen, and then they can project the characters instead of having one screen your wall.
So it's
you
like
have all these little
the space.
Fog areas that they can project the image onto, and you're in the show talking to the characters.
And can the fog move around?
And well, yeah, sure, yeah, you know, maybe. Eventually.
Like a hologram, like a
kind
of hologram.
Yeah, and you're part, and you're sitting there, and you can talk to the character, and that. And I was thinking when you talked about that, you know, are we really here? Would you sign up for, you know, The Matrix? Now, young people listening to this probably never even saw The Matrix because it's just so old. But
I just rewatched it actually.
Yeah, it's great.
It is great. It made a lot more sense.
So, like the idea of would you plug yourself in, knowing that you're doing it, but the other side of it is once you're in, it feels like you're performing to great audiences every night, and you're getting that same thing.
Endorphin rush or whatever.
It feels like it's real.
Yeah, and you wouldn't know.
When you sign up, would you commit to entering that world?
Would I know, once I was in that world, would I know I was in that world? Would I have the feeling that this is all... Okay, so in that case...
So you know, and you know once you're in that it's fake, but it's still awesome.
Yes, but I think the problem for me would be that I know it was inauthentic. You know, I would wonder what could my life had been had I not...
Could I have done this without the fake world?
Would I have felt better about myself? You know, if I had done this on my own, wouldn't that be ultimately more gratifying, you know? I think maybe entering that world and not, and feeling as if that was the real world and not knowing I made a choice, I probably still wouldn't do it, because it's so hard. It's the whole, this whole authenticity thing, right? Where we want things to be real, but what is even real? I think even like, you know, everything counts. Everything is real. Even fake plants aren't necessarily, you know, they're fake, but they're still real yeah. things. I battle with this idea of authenticity, and it gets thrown around so much, especially nowadays, where you have to be, you know, you have to be authentic. You have to come across as a real person. But I don't see how I don't see any other way of being real. You know, even if you're nervous or you are pretending to be something that you're not, in a way that is still you. I don't quite know where I'm going with this, but I guess my answer is no. I think I would stick in the was the red pill. I think I would probably choose the red pill and stay in this world and not go down the rabbit hole, as Morpheus says.
Yeah.
What would you do?
I thought about it a lot of when the initially I thought about it when I was in college, and philosophy
mm-hmm.
professor posed the question of, you fall in love with a girl, and it's like a standard thing. You fall in love with this girl and you're like, great, then you like want to spend your life with them.
Yeah.
And then she says, well, I'm a robot that's been designed to make you fall in love with me, designed by my looks, sure. my personality, sure. you know, like, we have arguments when we're supposed to, so yeah. that the resolution feels better.
Yeah.
Everything is designed
yeah.
for this optimal
right.
thing.
Right.
Do you say, no, I don't want to enter this Matrix world?
Uh-huh.
Or do you say, yeah, before I knew that, everything was great.
Right.
So do I keep going? And I have always like, yeah, like, that sounds great.
Yeah. But don't you
give me a robot? Yeah. Where are the robots at?
But I think there's a Twilight Zone episode on that, actually.
Did you see Ex Machina?
Ex Machina, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man, I loved that movie.
So that kind of flipped the thing of, oh, maybe yeah. we can't
yeah.
do that. Because if it's that good,
yeah.
then it's going the robot is yeah. going to start to
kill us. Oh, sorry.
Look for. Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert. Hey, screw up.
No one dies.
So, yeah, I don't know. I guess watching that and realizing, who cares?
Mm-hmm.
Spoiler alert. It's terrible at the end.
Yeah.
The robots are bad.
Yeah, it's frightening because they will take over. It will be Judgment Day, and it seems like that would be the case. But I don't know. I feel like I like the idea of not knowing what's going to happen. I like the idea of being taken by surprise. I think that bad experiences are just as valuable and exciting as good experiences. In fact, they're important for good experiences to exist.
Yeah.
If all there were good experiences, then there would be no such thing as good experiences, just experiences.
Yeah.
Funny thing, though, about Ex Machina, there was a song when you first walk into the house. That programmer's house is his estate.
Yeah.
He's playing this beautiful piece of music, and I had to look it up because I was obsessed with it. It's Schubert. It's one of his, I think it's a nocturne. And I got that picture right there, that little etching right over here from an antique store the next day. No, right there on the side of the wall.
Oh.
Yeah. Of Schubert. The next day, like, I saw it. I'm like, oh my God, I must have that. So, anyway.
Huh.
Takeaway is listen to Schubert, because it's good enough for Ex Machina and it's good enough for anybody. So,
nice.
Yeah.
Cool. I don't know where that wall went.
Yeah. Well, what
for
was
people?
Sure. That's okay, right? I mean, it's okay not to go anywhere. So, why does everything have to go somewhere? I kind of like the idea of it just falling off a cliff and burning down.
If anyone's still here.
But it brings up that question again. Would you prefer that you take a pill and make sure that every conversation, you know, ended up going where you wanted it to go? Or isn't it better that we don't know where it's going and that it takes us by surprise?
Yeah. I guess no robots.
No
for
robots.
Us.
No. Now, I wouldn't say no to a sex robot. Like, you know, just a companion.
Yeah.
Until I found a real person.
Yeah. All right.
Well, I have found a real... I mean, I do have a girlfriend.
Yeah.
Just to make that clear. I'm not that lonely.
A robot. So, speaking of other people and interactions with other people,
mm-hmm.
who has been a big inspiration or somebody that you look up to for, you know, in the magic and entertainment world, I guess, mm-hmm. or outside of that?
Well, a few people come to mind. One of my biggest inspirations is Rod Serling of The Twilight Zone. Just such great stories, I think. And that's been a big inspiration is in terms of creating plots as a performer or creating very clear ideas. He is just a master of that. And talking about important things to having a particular slant on the world and not just creating stories for story's sake, but, you know, wanting to get his kind of philosophies across. And he just did that so well. And he had standards, which, you know, high standards, which he lived up to. So I'm a huge fan of Rod Serling and certainly try to emulate whatever kind of philosophies he had. Also, Darren Brown is obviously huge, huge, huge inspiration. Has always been. I remember I first read his books, which are Absolute Magic and Pure Effect. I read them on a plane, or part of them on a plane, and it just felt like this is what I want to be doing for the rest of my life. He's articulating it in a way that makes me realize, God, I could really, really, this doesn't have to be this cheesy thing, you know? Yeah. This can be such a wonderful experience and a creative experience, artistic experience. Not to say that, you know, magic is art or isn't, but I don't really know, but it certainly can feel artistic, and there's a lot to be gained from that. So he's been so, so inspiring. Who else would I say? Penn and Teller, but only because I grew up in Vegas, and they did stuff their way, which I loved. Yeah. You know, they didn't stick with the status quo, which I can hugely appreciate. Plus, they did Broadway, which is inspiring, you know, to know that people in this field can do that kind of thing. And maybe some other musicians. Maybe a funny one that people wouldn't expect is a guy named Andrew W.K. Do you know Andrew W.K.?
Yeah.
So he was an inspiration to me in high school. And for some reason, I just kind of lost touch with the whole thing and then rediscovered it maybe about a month or two ago.
Yeah.
And just something about him is so mysterious and so inspiring and so uplifting. I just can't help but feel good when I listen to his music, you know? I even had that experience of almost coming to tears again. I was listening to a song called Really in Love, and I used to listen to it when I was in love with this girl in high school. And I listened to it like a month ago, and then those feelings started rushing back to me out of nowhere. And I think music has a real power to do that, like from, you know, to anchor in feelings. So it's a good way of pumping yourself up. It's a good way of feeling, you know, sad again, which I think is a good thing. It's a good way of just feeling, you know, feeling alive.
Yeah.
So I think those would be three people that kind of come to mind off the top of my head.
Cool. Yeah. I was actually talking to Andrew WK's people about doing the podcast, and they were all about it, but then scheduling like didn't work out.
Continue doing it, because he does everything.
Yeah.
He really does. He will do any, he's done like the tiniest, strangest things in the world. I mean, this is way bigger production that I've seen him do. Yeah, I would stick with that.
Yeah, they were like, yeah, it's great. It sounds good. And then like something was on tour or something and then it like kind of fell through, and then I reached out again and then I didn't get the response. So I kind of just gave up on it. Like, all right, when it like feels right again,
maybe three I'll times a charm
it again, and see if we can get them on, cuz it'd be great.
Yeah.
One of the coolest things for me in the show business world is people that are like that, like people that you like grew up, like now, especially having a podcast, I realize that like I can just email somebody and about 20% of the time they email me back of somebody that's like somebody like Andrew WK. It's not like a A-list celebrity.
Right.
But it's somebody that like you wouldn't think you could just hit him up.
Right.
And like his manager like got back to me.
Yeah.
And it's like so many times that happens where I reach out and people are like, yeah, like one of the biggest ones was Andrew McMahon, who's the singer of Something Corporate and Jack's Mannequin, who like I grew up listening to. And I like tried to get a podcast interview with him and it didn't work out, but I like got a podcast interview with his opening band.
Wow.
And I'm at the venue, like, backstage, and I'm doing the podcast with ex-ambassadors who, at this point now, are kind of blew up, you know, in the past 6 months. They're just massive now. And as I'm packing up backstage, I'm, like, loading up my stuff, about ready to just leave. I see Andrew McMahon, like, come over to me. He's like, hey, man, what are you doing?
Not as if, like, sure, what are you sure. doing here? But, like, sure. hey, I'm just involved. Here yeah, by yeah. myself.
Yeah, yeah. Wow.
What are you, like, why are you, you don't look like somebody I know, so yeah, yeah. what's up? And I was like, oh, I'm just doing a podcast interview with ex-ambassadors. Do you want to do one, too? And he's like, yeah, 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 for sure.
That's amazing. And one door opens,
like,
right? Yeah.
Great. And then he's like, I get it. You know, he's like, I was like, yeah, I'm Chris. And he's like, his phone's ringing right then. He's like talking. He like talked for like 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, is he just going to have to run now? And he's like, he came over and they're like, I'm like sitting over in the corner. And he's like, hey, Chris, all right, ready? And I was like, oh, you know, it's like, and he was somebody that he was so nice.
Yeah.
And he had no reason to be. Like, sure. he could have just been like, he was playing to like 1,000 people, sold out room that night. Sure. He could have just been like, no, like, I'm above this kid with a, you know, a backpack backstage.
Yeah.
And he was like so nice and so just friendly and open
wow.
and willing to help and, you know, just, you know, his no reason, he got yeah, nothing
yeah.
out
yeah.
of
yeah.
me posting the podcast.
That's amazing.
Him. But it was like a great thing for me and such a nice boost. My point of that was the coolest thing about this world of, especially in show business, is meeting people that you look up to and mm-hmm. then finding out that they're like, they can be like your friend.
Hopefully. Yeah. I mean, you kind of, that's the dream. Because I've always heard that you're not supposed to meet your heroes because they could have clay feet.
Yeah.
Right? They crumble beneath you or they yeah. say, you know, get out of here, kid. I don't want to talk to you or whatever.
Right.
But every once in a while you get someone that surprises you.
Yeah.
That is so endearing and sweet and kind for no other reason, just to be kind.
Now, I kind of wanted to, I don't know if you want to go into it or not.
Mm-hmm.
We can chop it out if not. But
okay.
that world of the person that you brought up with Darren Brown,
mm-hmm.
Do you want to talk about that?
We can talk about it, sure, yeah.
getting involved with actually not just the guy that you're reading his book,
yeah.
but actually, you know.
Yeah, it seems ridiculous.
In real life.
It seems unfair and ridiculous and not something that I deserved at all. there are much better people than me that, you know, could have taken that opportunity or been given that opportunity. So I just feel so incredibly grateful that ever happened. And I think it happened because of Twitter, largely.
Yeah.
But,
well, so for the people that are listening that don't know,
yeah.
you want to give them a quick little whatever you're willing to talk about.
Yeah. Well, so Darren is a mind reader, I guess you'd call him. I'm sure he wouldn't agree with that, but he's a mind reader or a mentalist in the United Kingdom, really big kind of name over there, I think. And he was a hero of mine, and as the stars aligned, so to speak, he invited me to go on tour with him. And I still to this day kind of think that was all a big dream. And so we decided to do that. And there were a lot of complications with what do they call that? Your visas
yeah,
and stuff,
yeah.
which thankfully ended up working out. And went over there for 2 years, toured with him, worked on the show, you know, helped out, got to see, you know, how that world kind of works. And became friends, like really good friends. It wasn't just like an employer kind of situation. It was employer-employee. It was just, you know, someone I can email or call up and chat and laugh and make fart jokes with. It's just something that's so incredibly strange. I don't quite have the same, you know, hero feelings anymore, although he is still a hero, but I don't feel that nervousness anymore.
Yeah.
It just feels like someone I can laugh with, which is more than I could possibly ask for, you know? So yeah, that's basically all that was.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. And that's what I was just talking about earlier, where like when that happens and it works and they're not,
yeah.
you know, a jerk.
Yeah.
Or, you know, and they're not just push you off where like, you know, it's amazing. That's what I'm trying to do with people, you know, whatever it is, like encourage people to, if you're thinking about something,
yeah,
try it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you know, it's like I get probably 90% of people that I just want to interview for the podcast or
yeah.
shows that I'm trying to book, 90% of the time people say no
mm-hmm.
or don't respond to me at all,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of worse than a no.
Sure, yeah.
But more than 90, I'd say.
Yeah.
You know, and now I'm trying to do a lot of like morning TV shows,
mm-hmm.
morning news programs when I'm on the road. And that number is way higher than 90% no's.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
like 99%
yeah.
no's. But I have, like we were saying, this is episode number 35 or
mm-hmm.
something, I think, of
wow.
the podcast. So,
yeah.
like, you know, a lot of
the
people said no.
Yeah, yeah.
But sometimes people say yes.
Sure.
And I have a handful of TV appearances.
Yeah.
And I was
last month, I was on the Ellen Show.
Yeah,
like,
which is amazing.
The best TV show ever.
Sure, yeah.
And it's like, how do you do that? Well, right. Hey, I'm going to tell Ellen I want to be on her show.
Right.
Okay, well, the Cleveland Morning News said no.
Right.
So why would Ellen say yes?
Right, right.
But sometimes they say yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have really cool video
sure.
to prove that.
Sure.
I was there. I kind of don't remember part of it.
Right, right.
I was like, well, it's really happening. I'm so nervous.
Right.
So that's a message to the people that something crazy. Like, for me, that's one of the biggest things. Like, be on mm-hmm. Ellen and mm-hmm. do a juggling trick mm-hmm. on Ellen.
Mm-hmm.
And then it happened.
Yeah.
You know, after 5 years of trying.
Yeah.
But it happened.
Yeah.
Because I didn't stop trying to make it happen.
Sure.
So I like to kind of wrap things up with...
Oh. that makes so much fun, though.
With you. I mean, what else is there? Is there any other ideas before we kind of get to the end?
Ideas?
That you have that you just would like to... I don't have a specific question.
Sure. I think a big thing for me, at least in the last year, has been... I probably touched on it earlier, but it's just getting rid of the ego and chopping away at that. And feeling like you're allowed to make mistakes. You're allowed to do something stupid. You're human. In fact, you should seek those things out. You're allowed to feel afraid. You probably should feel afraid. That's a feeling of being alive. That's a good feeling. And all these reasons that you come up with for not doing something that you know you should be doing are just... They're just honestly bullshit. I mean, they're just silly reasons that stop you from doing something which could create an amazing life for yourself. And even if none of it works out, even if you end up not doing the things that you wanted to do, you're still doing things which make you feel good internally, and that ultimately is the reason you do them in the first place.
Yeah.
So I went through this whole phase where I would, you know, was maybe a little bit more stoic in thinking, or which I still kind of am, I guess, but... You know, like having less desirables, which is, you know, good in some aspects of life. But I also think having a big idea of something that's bigger than you, something that you want to follow, not something that you want to attain in the far distance. I think that can be tricky because even if you get there, it might not be good enough. But having a feeling of right now, this is the feeling that I want to have and I want to keep exploring this feeling, constantly staying in that moment and constantly taking a risk and constantly being vulnerable is the most valuable, you know, life experience that I've had in the last year. It's, you know, shot my well-being through the roof. It's
yeah.
just been quite incredible. And that doesn't mean I've had experiences that weren't bad. I have, but those experiences I value just as much, if not more, than the good ones, because those are the ones that make the good ones great.
Yeah.
Right? You have to have those crappy things. When I first moved to New York City, when I first got here, I had basically no money. And I... First apartment I found... First, I went to this, like, sort of halfway house, kind of crack den thing, which I found because this loft-to-stole thing that I was looking at was shut down when I got here. So I found this other one in like, Brownsville, deep in Brooklyn, really kind of shady area. And they're, like, you know, I'm in this room with three bunk beds, all these, like, you know, guys and girls, six of us in this room, and it's January 1st, you know, first day of the year. And I'm there for a week until I find this apartment. I end up finding this apartment in Bushwick. It's called the McKibben Lofts, which is as a known source as a bed bug epidemic, right? It's just terrible. I have eight roommates. They all have cats.
What year is this?
This is 2000 and I want to say 10.
Yeah, right. It must have been 2010. So it's like Bushwick is still kind of scary.
Yeah, right next to the projects, getting called Whitey all the time, getting shot with BB guns from people.
People now are like, oh, Bushwick, that's cool.
Yeah, yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, six years ago.
It was pretty desolate and pretty different. Very different, I thought. You know, it was not a happy time. And my friend visited, who knew me as kind of like an overprivileged white kid from Vegas. Which is true, you know, I grew up in a nice family, dad, you know, made a good living and stuff. So this was just what the doctor, this is what I needed. I needed to be kicked down to show what the real world is like in order to feel what it feels to make something for yourself. So I say get out there and just fuck shit up, make mistakes, and that's how you're going to learn to you know, rise above all that.
Yeah, that was where I was going to end with asking you what type of advice you have for the kids.
Yeah, I think
but
that would
you
be
just
it.
Did it.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to just drop in not a typical follow you here and here and here, mm-hmm. but I know you've been more actively, again, writing on your blog, mm-hmm. which is great, which I highly recommend people. It's one of my favorite places to read about things and thoughts.
Sure.
I think you kind of got a vibe of the listeners here of what type of stuff it might be about. And there's all kinds of fresh ideas of just in general things to think about.
Yeah. Oh, that's
a lot of people don't. Maybe it's like a fresh way of thinking about it. Go read the blog.
Right.
It's whoiscooper.com/blog.
Mm-hmm.
So whoiscooper.com/blog. Where else do you want to guide people to look at your stuff?
You know, I'm kind of not very active anymore on social media. I just use it to post things. I would say maybe Instagram. Everything is at whoiscooper. It will always be, has always been. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, website. It's just Who is Cooper. Search it and you'll find it on any social media if I'm on that platform. But I like taking pictures and I probably start again on Instagram. So maybe go there. But I got to say thank you for even knowing that the blog exists, first of all.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you're my reader, the one reader that's actually looking at the damn thing. But it's just an exercise because I know I'm you know, not a very good writer and I'm trying to learn to be a better writer, and that's the place to do it. And yeah. Have to publish it, so it's another example of doing something.
Yeah,
I feel it's kind of silly.
I think it's a great thing of what you were just saying, and
yeah.
You're not just saying it; you're doing it. And
sure.
Again, for people that people ask me, I get questions a lot about like publishing a book.
Right.
And it
yeah.
Started as a blog. Like
yeah.
I basically knew I started writing these short essays.
Sure.
I was like, I want to write a book, but that's crazy.
Yeah, it feels crazy.
But I can write, a couple pages every day.
Yeah, totally.
And in 6 months, I went from a blank computer screen to a book in my hand.
Yeah,
it's 150 pages.
Incredible.
And it was like crazy.
Yeah,
you know, it was like, and I did everything myself.
Right.
As I didn't know how to lay out the book.
Right.
I didn't know how to write the book.
Right.
I didn't know how to do anything.
Right.
How to publish it. How to get it printed. How
right.
to do anything.
Right.
But in like 6 months.
6 months is amazing.
It was done and it was
yeah.
finished, and it's like it's a real book.
Yeah. And had you not done it, and when that 6 months rolled around, you would have wished that you started 6 months prior.
Yeah.
You know, it's always, you always live back. Oh, I wish I started that earlier. Well, then start now. Just start now. Just start doing it, you know? Because the worst case is you end up with some really interesting thoughts on things. I mean, even if the book wasn't published, which is great that it was, but even if it wasn't, you still had all that energy and time invested in thinking about what you're doing. And that is so much more valuable, I think, in the actual publishing in the first place, you know? It's getting to think clearly about what you're doing. And writing is the best way to do that.
Yeah.
You know, I find I don't know much about anything until I write about it. It helps you think about it in different ways and understand different things about, you know, what it is that you're trying to communicate. So I think it's great. I think it's awesome. The book is awesome. Good for you, man.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And we'll end on, I think, the theme of this is in line with the book. Just go. Make things happen. If you make things happen, they might suck. And then you can do it
they
again.
They should suck.
And
they,
you
they
can do it
suck.
Again and it'll be better.
Yeah.
So get the crappy one out of the way.
Yeah, yeah.
So that you, next year,
yeah.
when you're instead of thinking about it still,
yeah.
you make the good one.
Yeah. It's only up from here, yeah. Wow, well, thank you so much for having me.
That's it. Thank you for listening. There was some great stuff in there, and I think things keep boiling down to stop waiting for things to happen, get out there, and make it happen. No one else is going to do it for you, so you need to do it for yourself. So take advice of pretty much everyone who I've been talking about. Every time something cool happens, it's because they took that initial steps, aka just go, make it happen. Thanks for listening. As always, if you want to send me an email, go to chrisruggiero.com/podcast. Click on the contact form. Send me an email. Love to hear what you guys are thinking about. And I would also like, even if you don't have anything to contribute to the actual episode, could you do me a favor and drop me a message and tell me where you're listening to the show, if you're listening to it on the website or on iTunes or on Stitcher or on the podcast app? I'm trying to get an idea of where people are downloading this so I can make it better for that platform. So do that, and thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the Chris Ruggiero Podcast.